The secrets of termites. Maine author Lisa Marganelli has spent the past decade obsessed with the world of termites, and not just how they behave or how long they've been around. Marganelli is fascinated with what termites tell us about scientific inquiry, concepts like swarm intelligence and microbial cooperation, and the meaning of life itself. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Marganelli's new book, Underbug, An Obsessive Tale of Termites and Technology, introduces us to researchers all over the world studying termites and thinking about what they might mean for the future of humanity. Have you ever seen a giant termite mound and wondered why and how termites built it that way? Have you encountered termites in your life? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Most people don't have a very positive reaction to seeing or even thinking about termites. But a new book might change this lowly insect's reputation. The book is titled Underbug, An Obsessive Tale of Termites and Technology. The author joins me today to talk about why she has written a whole big book about these critters. Lisa Marganelli is an award-winning journalist and author of the national bestseller, Oil on the Brain, Petroleum's Long, Strange Trip to Your Tank. She lives here in Maine. And as always, we want to hear from you. Have you ever observed termites at work? Have you ever wondered what scientists can learn from them or from insect behavior? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome, Lisa Marganelli, to Maine Calling, and congratulations.
Thank you.
A fascinating book. I'm going to start with this, and you filled my head. You've expanded my little brain, Lisa, and I'm going to be thinking about some of these concepts for a long time. But I want to ask you personally, how did you, a girl from Maine, get obsessed with termites of all things?
Yeah, I don't know. I think the termites got me, maybe, rather than me getting the termites. I never saw termites in Maine. I never saw termites growing up. I had been living and working in California for a long time, and I had done a book about oil and was thinking about, well, what is after oil? When I heard about some researchers in California who worked for a government lab who were doing this weird genetic research on termite guts to see if they could get ideas from termite guts to make biofuels. And the connection between that is that termites have lots of microbes in their guts that allow them to eat wood, and it's very hard to eat wood in nature. That's why they can eat your house. But the idea was that if we could copy those sort of microbial tricks that they have, we could then turn that into, making biofuel, which would be making fuel out of scrap paper and scrap wood and all kinds of things like that and putting it in our gas tanks. But I did a story on them, and then they asked me to go out. After the story was all done, they asked me to go out and go on a termite safari with them. So I ended up driving through the desert with these like 11 really, really smart, really educated people trying to find termites. And it turns out that geneticists can't find termites. So because all they do is like they're in labs and they look at computer screens all the time. So we also had an entomologist along, and we were just like driving around on this crazy thing trying to find 8,000 termites. When I actually saw the termites, I was kind of blown away. They were so dumb and little and pink, and they're not exactly pink. They're just kind of translucent. They're kind of like little nobodies. They're about the size of a child's fingernail clipping. They were all clinging together in a long kind of icky string. And I was just like, wow, this is weird. But I didn't know at the time that I was going to get sucked into the termite world.
Because this was a decade ago.
Yes.
a decade ago.
The summer of 2008, it was when I went on the first termite safari. And then I went on two more termite safaris with that crew afterwards. And it basically became a way of life. And then I went to Africa and watched other researchers doing work on termites and also to Australia.
And what you found is that all over the world, there are people who didn't intend this to happen, but termites have become a way of life. And scientists from all different fields of study.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, termites are suddenly a little bit hot as something to study. For the past probably 15 or 20 years, most of the scientific study on termites has been about how to kill them. But increasingly, there are articles about how to imitate them by, like, either trying to eat wood or how to imitate the way they build. They build huge mounds. How to imitate the way they build or how to imitate the way they swarm. There's something about what termites do that humans really want to copy.
But this is only recent, right? Because the charismatic insects up to this point have been bees and ants, right?
Yeah.
And termite
totally.
People are not too happy about that, are they?
Well, it bums them out. I mean, it's you go to the social insect conferences, which, you know, that sounds kind of weird, but there's, you know, hundreds of people studying bugs.
Wait a minute,
bugs.
Social insect conferences. Okay, go on. I just had to pause a minute.
There's conferences where people study social insects get together all at once, and the bee people get up and they talk about, like, literally feeding bees cocaine and then watching them exaggerate how much pollen they've found. I mean, it's like a story from a disco. And the termite people are just like, well, I can either get money from an exterminator company or I can do some little studies in my lab. But, like, the idea of getting some, you know, like, really to be able to do really fancy studies is not something that's has really been available to termite people.
So I want to hear some of the basics. I was surprised to learn that a termite is a kind of cockroach. How is that possible? They don't look anything alike.
No, they don't. Well, 150 million years ago, cockroaches were solitary, and they ate fallen fruit. And they just hung out in the forest and did their thing. But they couldn't eat wood. Then some of them seem to have Well, we don't know the exact story, but here's like one hypothetical story. So they picked up some microbes that allowed them to eat the wood because the microbes could dissolve the wood. And the problem with the cockroach is that they molt their guts. They molt their intestines. So they needed to find some way of keeping their microbes with them. So what they started doing was their behavior changed and they started eating wood shake. There's no nice way to put this, but they were eating from each other's butts. That allowed them as a group to keep their microbes with them because individually they'd molt the intestines. And then they began to just, like, really evolve quickly to becoming social so that they not only shared their digestion, they also shared breeding because they have a king and a queen, and the king and the queen do all the reproduction, and the workers and the soldiers just have their own sort of jobs. The king and the queen emits a pheromone that keeps most of the workers and soldiers as children. Their development is arrested. So it's a neoteny. It's like it's always 4 o'clock at the mall in the termite mound. And then the soldiers are sort of a little bit like an immune system. They guard the termite mound. And the workers run around gathering, you know, grass and wood and anything else they're going to eat, and digging holes and building mounds and doing all this sort of stuff. And the king and the queen just hang out in a very small space and reproduce. So all of that sort of evolved based on this sharing microbes.
So I wanted to ask you about the mounds because, you know, you mentioned some of it, how there are these different jobs, it appears, for different termites. So later in your book, it's clear that maybe some don't have a job at all, but we won't go to that yet. Yeah. But this brings up one of the big concepts. There's some really big sort of mind-blowing concepts in this book, and one of them is, so what's the organism? Is the termite the organism? The termite can't exist without the mound. Is the mound the organism? You said in the mounds in Africa, there is a fungus that's kept in a chamber that's tended to, and the mound itself has lungs. And this is a question that's not really been answered, is it?
No.
And it's very much debated.
It is. It's very much debated at many different levels. So one way of looking at termites is that they're a superorganism. So that means that the individual termite isn't really doing much. The individual for a termite really is the king and the queen and, you know, a million workers and couple hundred soldiers, and that together constitutes one being. But then also you might need to throw in their gut microorganisms or the ones that you mentioned in Africa who farm a fungus in the basement. You might need to throw all of that in, and then you'd have a super duper organism. So the scientists haven't really decided at which level you analyze the termite. There's a lot, some scientists will analyze it at the level of the mound or the colony, and some look at it specifically at the level of the individual, and some also look at it more at the level of looking at all their symbiotic microbes and funguses and things like that. I found it just like an endless kind of question, because like when you really think about, well, who am I? My gut microbes are huge, and they may be telling me that I need coffee or I mean need water, or they may be kind of in charge. And I think that's another weird thing that you get with the termites is we kind of think that the queen is going to be in charge of everybody because that's like our, because we named her a queen. But we don't actually know where anything is particularly in control. The control just sort of evolves out of the group.
So is the fungus in charge? Are the microbes in charge? Who knows? I want to talk about all the different ways we're mentioning of approaching termites, from biologists to physicists to roboticists, in a little bit. But what strikes me after you're reading your book and then just following the news this week, how much is in the headlines this week that has some relation to the study of termites? And let's start with the huge headline that a scientist in China has allegedly used the CRISPR technique to genetically modify twin babies. This story is related to your book and to termite science. You have a scientist who discovered what evolved
into CRISPR. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. Sorry. I was like, no scientist in my book modified a termite. Yes, CRISPR. CRISPR had been showing up in genetic surveys of all kinds of microbes for years. And one of the scientists in the book had, sometime back around 2007 or 2008, he had sort of collected all the stories of CRISPR and all the data analysis on CRISPR, along with a few other scientists, and put it together as a little paper that said, you know, apparently something's going on with CRISPR. CRISPR means, the P in CRISPR means palindromic. So what it is it's little sections of genes that read the same forwards as they do backwards. And nobody really knew what these weird palindromes in the microbial genes were doing. So he just sort of published a little collection of them, and life moved on, and he went on to do other things. And sometime around 2010 or 2011, they realized that CRISPR could be used to sort of snip genes and make deletions and make it possible to add things into genes. So you could kind of, knock out a few of the nucleotides on a gene structure, and then you could maybe put something back in using other sorts of enzymes. So they were able to kind of do this. And now, of course, it's just like 10 years later. And we're talking about doing it on human babies, which is totally unethical.
And this seems to happen over and over, where scientists are looking for one thing. They maybe notice something else, but then they move on. And that something else that was kind of noticed, kind of pushed aside, ends up being the really interesting and important thing in the long run.
Yeah. I think that was the other thing I learned hanging out with scientists for 10 years, is that when you have 10 years to watch changes, it looks really different than when you're just when you're just going in and doing reporting for a month on science. When you look at science for a month, it looks like there's real successes and failures that are, you can make a quick judgment about. But over the long term, you realize that it's really a big stream of information, and it's hard to place bets on in 2007 on what's going to be really important in 2018.
Another big New York Times headline this week, "The Insect Apocalypse Is Here," talking about how insects appear to be vanishing from the planet. And this is something that you've thought a lot about as you've been working on this book about termites.
It's true. The question of what's happening to the insects is very big and very moving. I mean, people I live up in Arousic, and people in there say that the number of mosquitoes has fallen even in the last 20 years, which you would think we would be rejoicing about. But I think we're sophisticated enough now to realize that even the pesty insects that leave are really important. So, yes, termites are... So I guess we have to address the question of termites being pests. There are about 3,000 kinds of termites, and only 27 of them are invasive and eat your house. The other ones are just sort of toiling away out in the trees and in the ground, and they're just doing their thing. And in many ways, they keep a lot of the world going because they sort of manage fertility. But those 27 pesty bugs, pesty species, are spreading quite fast. And so one of the things that's interesting about thinking about the sort of insect apocalypse is that some bugs are dying, and these pesty ones are in many cases thriving because they're the ones that get along with humans the best. They're the ones that like climate change. They like disturbed landscapes. They like where we've scratched out a road or a shopping mall. That's good for them. So we are a part of this, you know, we're sort of picking winners and losers among the bugs without actually realizing what we're doing.
You talked about the 20-something kinds of termites that actually do harm homes. You grew up in Maine. Termites, mm-hmm. as you mentioned, were not a threat to your home when you were growing up. What about now? Are there no termites in Maine? Are there termites in Maine? Do we know?
Well, this is a really good question, and I hope if people have termites, they call in. I don't know. I had a problem with carpenter ants, and I called an exterminator, and they told me that there were termites as far up as Brunswick. And I know my mom claims to have had some termites, but I think they came in on some old wood. So I think that there are termites that arrive in Maine, and they hang out for a little while, but it's not kind of the way it is in New York or Boston, where all the land is kind of saturated with termites. And any place you put a house down, you have to think about protecting it from termites. In the south of the U.S., you know, it's totally just overrun with termites. And anything you build, you really have to be worried about whether or not the termites are going to attack it. That's definitely not the case in Maine. And I would be curious of what people have heard. They say that they're moving north. Termites don't like cold that much.
They wouldn't have liked our last 2 weeks.
No. Someone sent me some termites in a special plexiglass container from California, sort of like an ant farm. And they actually died in October. We were trying to keep them warm, but, you know, it's Maine. We don't heat the house.
Oh, my gosh. Well, we're talking with Lisa Marganelli. Her new book is Underbug, An Obsessive Tale of Termites and Technology. This book has been, you've probably seen an article about it in a major publication. Well, Lisa's right here in the studio with us. What would you like to know about termites? Do you have termites in your home? Are you curious about swarm intelligence or how termites are used by roboticists? Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Maine Center for Coastal Fisheries, using a collaborative approach to securing a fishing future in the Gulf of Maine. Saltwater, fresh thinking. And South Street Linen, dedicated to creating stylish all-season linen clothing for women, made in Maine. SouthStreetLinen.com.
On the next Fresh Air, writing a memoir about becoming a widower, we talk with artist and novelist Jonathan Santlofer. He lost his wife 5 years ago after she had outpatient surgery. His grief and feelings of guilt were overwhelming, but he was someone not used to sharing his feelings until he started keeping a journal. Join us.
You can listen to Fresh Air this evening at 7 on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public's podcast shortlist is now getting underway. The shortlist provides access to a wide range of Maine's most informative, interactive, and entertaining podcasts, from politics to craft beer and everything in between. This week's featured podcast episode of the week is Experience Maritime Maine's Salts and Water podcast, Women Lobstermen of Stonington. Do you have or know a podcast created here in Maine that would be a great addition to the podcast shortlist? Send your suggestions to shortlist@mainepublic.org. The Maine Public Podcast Shortlist is at mainepublic.org. Click on Podcast Shortlist under our radio tab.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, what we know and don't know about termites. Joining me, Lisa Marganelli, who is a journalist and author of the new book, Underbug, An Obsessive Tale of Termites and Technology. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. I was talking about headlines this week. Lisa, if you Google termites this week, you are going to find lots and lots of articles about a discovery of an enormous network of more than 200 million termite mounds, not 200 million termites, but termite mounds in Brazil, some of them 4,000 years old, and that if you look at them from the sky, there's a pattern.
Yes. Yes, there is a pattern of termite mounds covering the area of Great Britain, I think, in Brazil. And these termites, so first of all, yes, they make a regular pattern. It looks like a polka dots from space. But if you drew sort of a shape around each of them, you would see that each termite mound is kind of in the middle of a hexagon. And that patterning of termite mounds forming these sort of interconnected hexagons over lots of land actually also happens in Africa, and it also seems to happen in Australia. And we don't know, we haven't really started looking through Asia. It's possible that the whole world is organized into hexagons by termites in the sort of temperate zone between 45 north and 45 south.
So when this story broke, is your collection and group of friends who you keep in touch with who study termites, has this lit them all on fire? Or are they all sort of like, oh, yeah?
Yeah, the people who study termite patterning were like, oh, yeah. We talked about that 2 years ago. However, about 5 or 6 years ago, people would not have believed that story. It's only been within the last 5 or 6 years that the idea that little tiny termites could make such massive changes in the landscape. It's only over the last 5 or 6 years that has become an idea that people would believe. I mean, it used to be that people, if you told scientists that termites were making that sort of pattern, they would say, well, that requires some kind of mastermind. But there's been a lot of mathematical modeling and kind of ecological work that's been done that sort of proves that termites can do this with their mini minds by sort of following simple rules. The other thing about that patterning that they do is that it seems to be really related to keeping the soil fertile, and it seems to actually protect landscapes against climate change. The termites do a lot of stuff in the soil, especially in dry places. They make it possible for the rain to soak in, and then they leave all sorts of nitrogen and other fertilizing things in the soil so that it grows plants. And they found in Africa that termites create this sort of polka dot of bright green, really tasty vegetation, like bushes and trees and stuff. And then that happens to be where the giraffes and the elephants like to eat. So you've got underneath the giraffes and the elephants, you've got these termites kind of doing their thing and keeping that whole kind of fragile ecosystem fertile and sturdy.
So a space the size of Great Britain, mm-hmm. a physical space the size of Great Britain with 200 million termite mounds, this is something out of science fiction.
Yeah, but termites kind of are science nonfiction. I mean, they're so weird and they're so uncanny. What did surprise me was they tried to calculate how much dirt those termites moved, and they moved 2.5 cubic miles of dirt, which is so much dirt. But even in the American Southwest, the termites are moving huge amounts of dirt in every hectare. They're just nuts. They're just obsessive, and they're constantly running around with little balls of dirt in their mouths. So When I first started visiting termites, I would look down out of the airplane as I was landing and see these patterns that I couldn't really decipher. But there was a pattern below me, but I didn't know whether I was, you know, I didn't know if I was looking at anything. Then I met a mathematical biologist named Corina Tarnita and an ecologist named Rob Pringle. And they actually studied how termites make these patterns. And they were doing mathematical modeling that showed, that's kind of revealed these patterns. And then once you looked at their models, it was possible to look down out of the plane and actually see how this modeling gets done. And all that seems perfectly sane. You're looking at these, you know, you're looking at a scientific paper and you say, okay, well, that sort of corresponds to what I know. And then there's this feeling of like, oh my God. So basically, termites are running around with balls of dirt in their mouths all the time underneath us. And if we could, you know, kind of speed it up, we'd look down and it would be like all the ground is moving. You know, maybe not in Maine because we don't have termites, but in places where they have termites, it's moving a lot.
We'll go to Marilyn, who's calling from Damariscotta. Hi, Marilyn. Go ahead. You're on Maine calling.
Hi, Jen. Thank you. We do have termites in Maine. I've had personal experience with the little critters.
In Damariscotta, Maryland?
No, in Kennebec County when I lived there. It was in Winthrop, actually.
Oh.
We built a house in 96. It had a little entry porch with a roof over it, which was, you know, part of the house was the floor of the second floor. And my daughter's bedroom was over that area, and she had the head of her bed up in that sort of alcove. So one day I'm out gardening and I see this constant line of marching, what I thought were ants.
Did they have wings?
I don't recall. Termites have wings?
No, but when they leave the nest, they have wings. So termites usually stay in the dark, but then when they leave the nest, they have wings. And so that's when that's like a lot of times people see them with wings.
Marilyn,
okay,
go ahead.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a long time ago, so I don't really remember. But I mentioned at dinner because I'd watched where they went, and they went into a post that was right under her bedroom, supporting the corner of her bedroom. So I mentioned at dinner that night, and my daughter said, oh, dear. And I said, what? Should have mentioned this. She said, at night when everything's quiet in the house, I hear munching, and I could never figure out what it was. It was audible.
Marilyn, did you end up having to call an exterminator?
Well, we called our builder. We had to take things apart. I mean, we thought we'd call an exterminator, and then we got to thinking about it, and we thought, well, if she can hear chomping every night, that means that whole beam up the corner of her room is getting eaten away. So we called the builder, and he listened, and he said, yeah, you got termites, and they may have done irreparable damage. So we had to do several things to get rid of them. I mean, they're incredible creatures. They were on all three floors. They were in a upright beam on the first floor on that little porch. They were in a beam in the corner of my daughter's room, and then it went up to a storage area on the third floor. And we cleaned the storage area out, and there they were in there, chomping away.
Oh, gosh, Marilyn, it sounds like you've had a nightmarish experience and what people in the rest of the country deal with commonly, right?
Yeah, this is pretty common in other places. I think Maine had always seemed like we didn't have the poisonous snakes and we didn't have termites, but it sounds like you had quite a termite infestation. I had one when I lived out in California. I didn't hear the munching, but people frequently do hear that munching sound. I didn't hear the munching, but the door of my apartment wouldn't shut. Everything was sort of getting out of square, so my landlord called somebody, and they ripped the back wall off and realized that the termites had basically eaten away all of the back beams in the house. And I was really lucky it hadn't just collapsed on me. It was right next to my bed. Maybe they choose the beds. I don't know.
Marilyn, thanks for your call. We have an email from Betty. I'm a master licensed pest control provider in Maine. In my 10 years, I've seen only a handful of termite infestations in homes in Maine. The farthest north has been Lewiston, but in most cases, they are brought in on lumber shipped up from southern states. Most often, people will call believing they have termites, but upon inspection, we find they are misidentified carpenter ants, usually swarmed, which are winged breeding carpenter ants. So thank you for that, Betty. We will go to Kai, who's calling from Phippsburg. Hi, Kai. Go ahead.
1 second, please. Good afternoon. Listen, Rupert Sheldrake did a book one time, Seven Experiments That Will Change the Way We Think, or the World, or whatever. And he did this experiment, or someone did, with an anthill in Africa where they stuck a big sheet of metal right through the whole anthill, left it there a year, let the termites do what they wanted to do, and then when they pulled it out, all the floors, all the little chambers that they made all lined up perfect. Have you ever heard of that?
I haven't heard of that. It's very interesting what happens to those. They call them anthills, but they're actually termite hills in Africa.
Yeah.
They're constantly being built and torn down at the same time. I mean, it's almost like the way our bones are constantly sort of being built up and torn down by our bloodstream. They're being hit by the sun on one side, and then they're frequently also hit by water, which will collapse them. And so the termites are kind of building them up, and then it's getting hit by the sun, and they build a little faster on the sun. One of the researchers who I followed in Namibia, his name is Jeffrey Scott Turner, studied these mounds, and he discovered that they are all sort of in line with the zenith angle of the sun. They all were actually, they came to kind of average out at the actual kind of angle of the sun at the top. It was very weird, this building and falling down, and how the termites were essentially calculating with the dirt where the sun was. So a lot of weird things happen in those mounds. And if you break into them, the termites will sense that the mixture of air in the mound has changed, and they run away from the break, making noises that set off an alarm with all the other termites. And then all the other termites make an alarm noise. And they all grab a ball of dirt, and they follow the smell of the fresh air to that hole in the mound. And then they build they drop their balls of dirt all right there on the border and build up a new wall. So I would believe almost anything about a mound, but it is also really important to actually watch that very meticulously, because it's easy for us as humans to think we know what's going on because of the way that there's something about when you look at a termite mound, you come to realize how much the human brain predicts what we're going to see. And sort of we have a hard time seeing it for what it is, I guess is what I'm saying, because in some weird way, the human brain is a little bit like a termite mound also.
Some of the scientists you've studied have poured plaster down into a termite mound and then brushed away all the dirt. And tell me about what they find.
Oh, gosh, they're really... So these termite mounds are made by Macrotermes natalensis and Michael Saini in Namibia. They're maybe 13, 15 feet high. Occasionally they're a little higher. They look like if you had a fist and you punched through from under the ground and then stuck one finger up and then tilted that finger about 27 degrees off the facing straight towards the sky, so that's the angle of the sun at that latitude. And so they look like they have a kind of a pedestal, and then they have kind of a spire. So once they filled them with plaster of Paris, which they had to put a tremendous amount of plaster of Paris into these things, they found these huge vertical tunnels that look kind of like bones, actually. And then towards the edge, there's like little capillaries. And this is the part that's above ground. And then right at the ground level, you start to have horizontal galleries, and those go down. Somewhere in there, there's a little area that's about the size of a soccer ball, and that's very, very hard. And inside that, the king and the queen are in a little area, oh, I don't know, much smaller than a donut, like a small, flat, whoopie pie-sized cavern for the king and the queen. And then underneath that, there are all of these galleries filled with the fungus, which the termites gather huge amounts of grass for and then tend. And then the fungus digests that grass. The termites come back, suck the sort of sugars off the fungus, and run off and feed their brothers and sisters. The fungus is a very crazy story. So when they fill that all with plaster of Paris, you get this incredible sculpture that just it makes you feel weird to look at it. It's like you're looking at it seems to have a personality.
You said that in Africa, often they're referred to as ant hills when they're really termite hills or termite mounds. What is the important distinction between ants and termites?
Well, they're totally different. Ants evolved social behaviors completely separately much later than termites. Termites, as I said, were 150 million years ago, and ants are much more recent. Ants and wasps and bees are all somewhat related, but termites are not related to them. So for one thing, it shows how incredibly dynamic and creative evolution can be, that it would come up with similar structures twice. For me, I don't think I could have written a book about ants, because when I look at ants, the way they move makes me itch. And when I look at termites, they kind of flow and it doesn't freak me out. So personally, that's the difference for me.
We're talking with Lisa Marganelli, her book Underbug, An Obsessive Tale of Termites and Technology. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Welch and Forbes. Customized investment portfolios, private trustees, family office services since 1838. WelchForbes.com. And the Maine Health Cancer Care Network. World-class cancer care right here in the place that gives strength. Home.
The federal government is releasing more school districts from requirements to integrate their classrooms by race and class.
It just bussed kids around so that they would meet the letter of the law, but never the intent of the law.
Critics say this change could make our schools even more segregated. A new investigation into the challenges of integration by the Texas Tribune next time on 1A.
1A can now be heard Monday through Thursday evenings at 9. And coming up at 2 is World Affairs. Blended Threats, When Cyber Attacks Inspire Terrorism. A discussion about the new types of cyber threats and the ways in which governments and corporate leaders are responding. You can listen to World Affairs in the next hour at 2 on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Termites and What They Teach Us. We're here with author and journalist Lisa Marganelli. Her new book, Underbug. Join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. By the way, Lisa, I love the jacket of your book. And it looks as though, I'll just try to describe it, there are holes in the jacket. And it looks like somebody has been eating it. And you don't see it until you take off the flap, but there are little termites underneath. Very creative. I'm sure you were thrilled when the...
I was super thrilled.
When you saw the design.
My sort of like motto for the book was, eat this book.
So we talked a little bit earlier about all the different kinds of scientists who are looking at termites. And one of the more interesting threads in your book is how roboticists, and I didn't even know there was such a thing as a roboticist, but now I know, are studying termites. And is this the idea that robots of the future can learn from termites?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Termites can cooperate with each other to accomplish big things like building mounds or building little walls without some kind of mastermind. And so there's a real question of what kind of little signals or rules are the individual termites following that result in the big changes like building a mound or building, you know, 200 million mounds over a space the size of Britain and Brazil. How is it? What are the signals that get them to lay down each ball of dirt? So if we could do that with robots, we could build things on Mars. We could build things in Afghanistan. We could send, we could use it to program drones so that they would go out and could scout for things the way termites go out sort of scouting through the ground for grass. We could send, we could also adapt it for software that could heal a network. For example, if something broke into a network, the network itself could sense that there was a problem. And then just as I described the termites running to heal the mound when they find a hole, they could follow that sense and go and fix it themselves.
But one of the problems with this whole idea of the study is there is an assumption, isn't there, that the termites are all the same, mm-hmm. and they don't really think for themselves.
Right.
So and?
Yes. So I started hanging out with the roboticists many years ago. And when they were first looking at the termites, they were assuming that the termites all did the exact same thing. Like every termite was a little bit like a robot because that's what they thought. And so some of their experiments were based on this assumption. And then one of the roboticists ended up sort of doing a side project where she figured out how to track the termites individually as they were building and digging. And she realized that they were not following the same program at all. What it turned out was, in addition to 25 termites, sometimes there would be four termites were digging and piling up balls, and 20 termites were just screwing around. They were running around. They were sniffing the dirt. One of them was just like standing and kind of rocking back and forth. And it was quite weird. And then the more she looked at these dishes, the more she realized that some termites were a little bit charismatic and they were leaders and they would get other termites to do work with them. But there still were an awful lot of them screwing around. This has actually been seen in ants and other social insects.
So this just throws all sorts of theories right out the window.
Yes.
So one of the things that's really wonderful, Lisa, about your book is that you are connecting what you're learning about termites and what you're learning about the scientists who study them to sort of a lot of broader concepts and really big concepts. So I've asked you to read a little section of your book that illustrates that.
Yeah. The roboticists were dreaming of a great triumph of rationality. All those repetitive iterations and abstractions to find perfect legs for a robot and simulate the perfect interactions between robots, all to create a collection of machines that together are emergent and fundamentally more than a sum of their parts, exceeding the rationality that built them. I understand why we want these machines. We want the self-healing computer networks and the dream of applying swarm intelligence to the stock market. But I keep feeling like there's another paradox buried in the idea of gaining control by creating mechanical versions of systems that control themselves.
And after you've had this deep thought, you have an experience yourself, which I think most people in Maine can relate to. You're trying to get out of Boston on a busy day, a rainy, busy, miserable day.
A busy, busy, rainy, miserable day. And I had been kind of confused, so I opened up my iPhone. This is like back in, I don't know, 2012 or something like that. I opened up my iPhone and said, you know, what route should I take? And it routed me to old Route 1, which is like really one of the worst ways to get out of Boston, but I guess everything else was jammed up. And there I was sitting, the water is pouring down the windows. I'm sitting in basically stop traffic there, and I'm realizing that we are all the robots. We have just all made essentially a wall of cars because our phones told us to go this particular route. And then we're all just going to sit there. And so I realized that I went looking for the robot and the termite, and she is me. And I also realized that, you know, maybe once we get this kind of special swarming software, it'll optimize everything for the group as opposed to the individual. And then I'll just go flying right out of Boston with no problems. But meanwhile, It was, you know the stations in Boston. They were all playing that Four Non Blondes song called What's Up, which is about hey, hey, hey. I said, hey, hey, what's going on? And it just was playing on every station. And there I was just trapped. And so I think that's one of the things is we, the robots that we want sometimes turn out to be ourselves.
The termites, and they're not sure. Nobody's sure why termites follow each other or do what they do. Maybe it's pheromones.
Mm-hmm.
Someone studying us from the sky may not understand why all of those cars were suddenly on old Route 1 when it was the GPS, the algorithm that went into the GPS. We'll go to Beth, who's calling from Harmony. Hi, Beth. Go ahead.
Hi. This sounds like a really interesting book, and I'm looking forward to reading it. I was wondering if in your studies of the termites, you looked at how people and cultures around the world use them as part of their diet. Like, are they edible? And what do they taste like? And did you taste any?
That's a wonderful question. They are used, so every year when termite breeding season comes in, the winged termites, who are the fertile ones made by the king and the queen, leave the nest. And so if you see termites, usually you see them with wings. Those termites are bigger and they're quite fatty. And many cultures eat them. They're eaten all across Asia. They're eaten in Africa. Different places have different sorts of recipes for termites. You do want to pull the wings off. And I never got a chance to eat them. However, a neighbor bought me some freeze-dried ones, and I ate them. And they're nice. They're a little fatty, a little bit like popcorn kind of, but maybe not so popped, not the corn taste. What they have is a little bit of sort of a bitter, proteiny taste. Now, the interesting thing about eating termites is that it might have made humans who they are. The Australopithecus, one of our sort of predecessors as humans, ate a lot of termites, apparently. Some apes today can fish for termites inside termite mounds. They create elaborate tools and they pull the termites out and eat them. So it's possible that Australopithecus's eating of lots of termites sort of allowed their brains to grow, which is why we're now talking to each other on the radio.
Beth, and thank you for your call. And if you didn't hear it, Maine Calling did a show a couple of months ago on entomophagy, which is the eating of insects. So
I heard it.
Okay, terrific. Oh. Thanks for calling in. We'll go to David in Heartland. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Lisa, I have a question. Could you talk about the role of termites in the global carbon cycle?
Sure. Termites are very important because they cycle a lot of they cycle tons and tons of plant matter into the ground or into just out as sort of out of the system. They then turn it into, they turn it into food. They turn some of it into gases, which could be methane or it could be hydrogen. And then they also store that, some of that in their feces in the ground. Termites both seem to sequester carbon in the ground and they also do release a fair amount of methane. The estimates for methane, which is a very powerful climate change gas, they range. The estimates were at one point in the 80s quite high. They're now about 4%. But when people really get down and try to measure exactly what's going on with termites and carbon, it gets really complicated because they build like tents over each little mound. And then they try to measure everything, and they realize that it's really different from season to season. It's different according to how the land is managed outside. But termites also do other things. In Australia, they burn there's a long-standing project of burning the landscape as a way of tending it. It turns out that some of the termites there have evolved to deal with that. So they eat the centers of trees. The centers of the eucalyptus trees are all hollow in the northern part of Australia. About 80% of the trees are actually hollow, which is a very weird thing once you realize that you're just looking around at a bunch of straws. That really changes the way the fires burn. It changes the carbon balance of the fires. The answer to your question is basically it's very complicated.
another thing we don't really understand about termites, right? Thank you so much, David. I want to talk very briefly about ethics. We talked earlier about CRISPR, which is sort of getting a lot of headlines this week. And you talk about in your book, Lisa, that there are whole other ways in which scientists are trying to manipulate life that aren't really as controversial, but maybe ought to be. For example, synthetic biology, another concept I hadn't heard about.
Yeah, the concept behind synthetic biology, there are a lot of different concepts, but one of them is that you can kind of create factory organisms, like an E. coli or a yeast, can be given a new set of genes so that they kind of work like a little refinery or a little producer of the chemistry that you're looking for. And that is very promising in some ways, because if we could move away from fossil fuels and if we could move away from petroleum as a feedstock for so much of the chemistry that we have, that would really be terrific. At the same time, it raises all sorts of questions about which problems we solve and who decides how we solve them. And also, who makes the money from solving them? That's another question. And how it sort of consolidates power or changes the circumstances of people's lives. So that's one thing that this brings up. Also, obviously, in the making of robots and swarming drones, the question of who, of how much power we give drones or how many rights we give to drones is a big question. The ethics of not having humans in the loop as we develop weapons are really huge. And so following termites brought me to some really big questions about the future. And I don't think we really have the answers to them yet, but it is clear that we need to start talking about all of this new technology.
All right. Well, Lisa Marganelli, thank you so much. I apologize to those of you left hanging, not able to ask Lisa a question. Her book is Underbug, An Obsessive Tale of Termites and Technology. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as links and resources at mainecalling.org. Today's program will be broadcast again tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and by Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the show, we will discuss the top news stories from Maine in November with three editorial page editors. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio. Nice job.